Hello everyone, welcome to yet another episode of Contact Lost, the Polish Warhammer 40k competitive podcast. I'm your host Tweak, with me I have my co-host Joker.
Hey guys.
And with us today we have the fantastic Team Canada, represented by the captain Chris Haynes.
Hello.
And Francois, whose surname the majority of Americans cannot pronounce, Lalonde,
if I'm not mistaken. That's very good. Yes, well done. Thanks for having us.
My French is mediocre, but at least I did some research to find out how to pronounce your surname.
And not, as most Americans think, Lalonde.
Exactly. Lalonde. Exactly. So I made sure that I don't mess this up. So here we are. And yeah, that's as far as my research into you guys goes. So maybe... to kick this off, let's hear a couple of words about yourselves. Chris, let's start with you. How long have you been playing this game? How did you become the team's captain? Tell us your story.
Yeah, okay. So I started when I was a teenager, long, long time ago. I'm 36 now, so that would have been 20-something. I think it's like 20 years ago. And yeah, I started playing actually in London, Ontario, which was like, it's like a medium-sized city. At there was a games workshop, and you walk by the mall, and you see these kind of pretty models, and you can't have enough of them. So I started playing orcs back then. And I kind of played competitively starting pretty young. We used to play 1,000-point tournaments. And then I took a break for college, came back in. And after college, when I kind of got my career started actually at the company that I'm at now, I kind of needed something to fill my spare time, so I started getting back into the 40k, and just started playing tournaments like two or three a month and kind of never looked back from there. About 2015, well, it started a bit earlier than that, 2014 2013, back when the WTC was the ETC, we started talking about getting a Canadian fantasy team at the time, not a 40k team. That was the predominant game back in 7th edition. It was a lot bigger here. So we started kind of talking about getting a team together, and it never really happened for multiple years. And then finally in 2015, we went to the Fantasy ETC. 40K was there in the room kind of next door. And then the game kind of exploded and blew apart and with Age of Sigmar. And so we switched to 40K the next year, which was 2016 in Greece. And that was when the first kind of this organization that we have now was started. The first captain for that year was Joe. It wasn't myself. He took over for me because I had a child. That year we got 14th out of 28th. 2017th in Spain, we got a Best Painted Award and 18th. And then 2018, that was captained by myself. And then 2018, I captained in Croatia, where we got favorite opponent, but we got sadly 26th, which is our lowest performance. And then 2019, pre-COVID, in Serbia, we got 16th and got another favorite opponent award. And then we took a couple years off for COVID, like the rest of the world. And then last year, we kind of came back after practicing on TTS through COVID. And we came back pretty hard and got 9th out of 28th in Belgium. So that's kind of the history. How it became me captain, that's still kind of a mystery. I think I was just the first one to do it. And last year I ran unopposed. It was our first ever actual captain election because there was no demand for it prior to that. And I guess we'll see how it goes in the future.
Yeah, fingers crossed. All right, Francois, how about you? So how did you get into that hobby, and how did you get on Team France? Team Canada, what am I saying?
Right language, wrong country.
He kind of, exactly. I don't know, it's not that far off, but I'm just kidding.
I was so wound up with the...
Surname fits.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I think I have the very common origin story, similar to Chris's, where I started playing as a teenager in my friend's basement. My friend Charles, in like the early 1990s, he was into it and he got me into it. I started with Fantasy as well. That was the larger game at the time, Fantasy 2nd edition. High Elves was my first army. Back then, you'd get cardboard models in your starter sets. It was awesome. And then shortly thereafter, I got into 40K. That would have been, I think, also 2nd edition. Anyway, the box set was Marines and Orcs and Goblins. And, well, not orcs and goblins, Grot. You had the little monopose ones with the guns up in the air. Mm-hmm. That set. So that was a very, very long time ago. And then, as most people do, I took a break for university. But I was in university for a very long time. So my return to Warhammer had to wait until I was done my PhD. I'm a historian, a history professor here in Ottawa. So I was in school for very long. And then when I moved here for work, I didn't know anyone, basically. So I had parent friends, right? The people you meet at baby swim class. That was kind of the extent of my social circle. And I was very bored and looking for something to do. And I remember walking past the game store and seeing the minis. And I'd always stayed up to date with the lore because I was always into that. But I saw the minis and I was like, oh, I used to love playing that game. And so I got in there and bought a couple boxes and started painting. Took a while to find like a play group and people to actually play with. But I met Chris not too long after that. That would have been 5-6 years ago, something like that. And the competitive scene here in Ottawa is very, very active. So there's lots of tournaments to go to. And so I just started going to tournaments. And for a few years, I lost a lot of games. So many games. It took a couple of years to finally get it and get good at the game. And I credit Chris with a lot of that learning, because a lot of those games that I lost were to him early on at those little RTTs. And yeah, from there on out, this is going to be my first time at WTC. Last year, I didn't feel I had the time or to commit to really be on the team fully. And so I didn't actually apply. But this year I decided to go for it. And thankfully, Chris and them thought that I was going to be a good match and selected me for the team. And I'm super excited to go.
Great. Okay. Cool. Thank you for that introduction. Joker, I see you, I know you have a question, but before I let you ask that question, to anyone who is listening to us or watching us for the first time, you might be wondering what's going on here. So first, and also, why is there that weird logo in the corner that is not contact lost? So the WTC 40K is an event that is happening this August, World Team Championships, and we are the official partner of that event. So we are here to do interviews with members of, let's limit ourselves to the top 10 teams from last year. Canada was in the top 10, the ninth place. We are doing this in random order just because it depends on, you know, how people can join us from what time zone and so on. Last time we spoke to Team Australia. If you haven't seen that, go back and see that as well. And today, the entire hour or more than an hour will be devoted to Team Canada. So stay tuned because there are some really, really interesting topics coming. Joker, now is your time.
Yeah, before I do that, I don't know, Tweak, if you're seeing us on the screen differently, but Chris did a much better job at pointing to the actual logo.
I know. I need to...
So thanks, Chris, for that.
Reach over there.
Yeah, so I was going to ask how stereotypically wonderful that Canadians are getting the favorite opponent award. But that's obviously a positive note. But you started going to the event quite late, one might say. Was that due to the popularity of the hobby in Canada, or maybe the fact that it wasn't as popular, or was it a matter of getting people together, or is it just a matter of, you know, the time and the money commitment to travel to Europe?
Yeah, so it would be all of the above. When you go back far enough, I don't think any of us even knew it existed, or at least this until, you know, I think it was well established at that point, the ETC. And it just didn't, like, we didn't play the play style, we didn't play the comp, we didn't play any of that kind of stuff over here. And that was kind of earlier days in the internet, and there wasn't that social media presence, so I don't think the information kind of trickled in. I do know that Canadian teams went before kind of we started our organization, but they were very sporadic. And a lot of the Canadian teams earlier on were like, because it's very common for other countries to have dual citizenship with Canada and themselves. Like, that's very, I feel like it's very common here for people to have a second citizenship. I have one, and there's like two or three on our team that have them as well. And so I think a lot of it was just people from the UK would kind of get one or two Canadians with them. They had Canadian passports, and they would kind of create that team. But yeah, the other side of it is that it is very expensive for the average gamer. You know, when you're thinking about, like, when we talk to the UK guys, they're flying for £200, right, for the weekend. It's kind of like a normal tournament. Whereas a lot of us, it's like a major ordeal. We have to buy our plane tickets well in advance. We have to commit. You know, you're looking at multiple thousands of dollars. And at the time, I don't think that was very popular. Even prior to 2015, you didn't see a lot of Canadians even in big U.S. events. You'd see some in certain pockets like Chicago and in the Northeast, but we didn't, wasn't as popular to travel back then, in my opinion. Could be wrong, but... and then, yeah, so our first teams, especially in the earlier days, I would say right up until 2019 was when we first started getting serious. But our early teams were like, who can go and who can afford to go? We would start the team. We'd get like 8 or 9 people. And then we would end with 4, right? A couple, like, you know, as soon as you had to put the money where your mouth is, we would end with 4. And so there was a long time when we were literally just like 4 passports and a bunch of mercs and kind of stuff like that. So.
Okay. So how did you find out about the, well, ETC back then? Did it just pop up randomly somewhere on the internet? Or, I don't know.
Were you jealous of the Americans?
US guys or, yeah.
I was very big into podcasting earlier. Like, we have a podcast of France 1 I do, but I've been doing it on, I'd say, more off than on for, like, 16 years. So we were very early into the days. And so... some of the big, a lot of like the WTC influence I got from the fantasy podcast of the UK, like Bad Dice podcast and like Heel and Hammer and all those kind of original fantasy podcasts, they would talk about it. And then I just kind of wanted to do it. And so that's literally how it started. Yeah. So.
Okay. So, Francois, a question to you. Chris just mentioned that, you know, it's a financial challenge. In the like pre-show, very short conversation that we had, I mentioned that, you know, you probably leave your families behind and so on. It takes a lot of planning. So there must be something about the WTC that actually is alluring, something that draws you to it year after year. So what would that be? How would you describe it?
Well, for me, so just to backtrack a little bit for the family aspect, I have 2 kids, right? Chris is 3. So that's a consideration. And part of the reason why I feel comfortable going this year and less so in previous years is that my kids now are older. My youngest is 9. So that's much more manageable, much easier to leave them behind for the, 8 days that we're going to be gone. Because it's not like a weekend. We're leaving on the Sunday and coming back the following Monday. So 8 full days away. But as it turns out, I leave for tournaments for weekends regularly, but this will be by far the longest and largest trip, right? It's very different to be gone on the Friday, back on the Sunday night or Monday morning than an entire week. But the WTC is something very special. I've never been, but many of my friends have, and they have great memories of the event. And I'm actually friends with members of other national teams. Some of those people I feel I'm quite close to. We talk online all the time, but I've never actually met them in person. Some I have, some I haven't. So it'll be, for me, one of the main motivators. Obviously, you're motivated to go play and do well, but one of the things I'm looking forward to the most is definitely meeting those people and hanging out.
Mm-hmm. So the camaraderie aspect of it. So, yeah. Okay. So, did you two need a lot of convincing? To do a lot of convincing to, you know, speak to your spouses, partners, families, and tell them, hey, I'm going to leave for 8 days to play Toy Soldiers. Like, are your families okay with this, or did it take a lot of work to actually get them on your side, Chris?
Surprisingly, not a problem for me. Sorry, I jumped right in there. But no, my wife is very, very supportive of my hobby, and she has her hobbies, and I'm supportive of her hobbies. And she knows that moving Toy Soldiers around the table and playing with my friends is very important to me and my mental well-being. And so when I said I want to go to Belgium for a week to go play Warhammer, she said, great, go for it. Right? Absolutely no issue whatsoever. And that's very lucky, obviously.
Chris, how about you?
Yeah, so I've been playing tournaments. Like, there's been years where I've had 20, 25 tournaments. I've been traveling for tournaments. long, long time. And so about 16 years ago or so, or 13, maybe it was about 14 years ago, I kind of moved away to like a, from where I'm originally from. And so for work. And so I ended up, I was single at the time, and I was, you know, part of the deal was I'm going to move right for this new job. And then I'm going to spend like one or two weekends a month traveling to tournaments. And I was doing that like crazy. And so I met my wife. I already had like a basement in a house I was renovating, like full of Warhammer. I had already been traveling two tournaments a year. And so we met 10 years ago. So we were only like a year or two into the relationship when I started going to Europe. So it kind of just was never a thing, right? It was just, this is just something I've always done, and it wasn't a new surprise, right?
And you know, you have a table
basement, yeah, that you've got in the back, ready to stream some games for Team Canada patrons.
Yeah, we don't do much streaming. I do have a pretty wicked stream set up, but this is a different house. I finished that project and moved on, and this is in a dark corner. Used to be a home theater room in kind of the back corner, and so there's no windows, which is really nice for a gaming room.
Streaming.
Yeah, and for, well, if I did, I think I've only done like three streams out of there. But as I said, I've been off on the Canhammer thing more than on the last 10 years. But it's never been hard. My wife is coming this year. We historically have tried to make a trip of it, so we'll go for 2 weeks and we'll kind of go around Europe as a couple, and then she kind of does her own thing for the WTC weekend. Recently, because we're being more serious as a team, I need more time in Europe. So like this year I need 8 days, like Francois, with the team in Europe. And so my wife is just, her sister is flying out and they're going to Amsterdam for the week. So I'm like, I'm off. And my mom took the kids, so I'm good to go.
Okay.
Sounds so fantastic.
So, Francois, you've mentioned meeting people, and I've been wondering, because I think that used to be an issue in Australia. Do you guys get a chance to meet up as a whole team and, you know, do practice gaming, or is that also like a whole endeavor in itself?
That is one of the challenges with a country like ours. In Europe, the distances are much shorter than North America. And so we have players from all over the country. I think the furthest away from us, Chris, would be Riley, who, if we were to drive to his house, would be a 37-hour drive or something like that. So, yes. So unfortunately, it's not really possible for us to do that unless everyone were to buy plane tickets, which are domestically in Canada very expensive. Many of us do live in the Montreal, Ottawa, Toronto corridor, so those people you see all the time at the same events. That's most of the team, but we have Kier from the Maritimes and Riley from out west, and Adam from even further west, you know, some people like that who we have to practice with on TTS. As much as TTS has its issues, the biggest quality, the biggest advantage it provides is the ability to do that.
Okay. So is there any kind of like community backing towards what you do? Or maybe if not backing, then perhaps expectations that, you know, a team is selected, a team goes to a world team championships, they should bring gold, for example, or something like that. So what does that look like in Canada? Because in Poland, you know, the whole community is pretty much centered around WTC and supports the team by organizing, like, all events here are done in WTC style, for example. There is a league that contributes, like, people who are top three get onto the national team. So everything spins around the national team. How about in Canada?
Yeah, so we were basically just like, I'm not gonna say like elitist, but it was a seen as like a boys club, just something that people went to because they could afford to, like, that's just kind of the reality of it back in the day. We got a lot of good responses generally because we happened to win a lot of painting and favorite opponent awards. And Canada was one of those countries historically until about maybe 5 years ago when the ITC really took off in the States and the American influence kind of happened. We were very much an overall country, where we didn't, generalship was like a side award. You had a best general, and it was always like overall 1, 2, and 3. So painting and sportsmanship at all of our big events. And so the people that were considered the winners up here were the overall players, whereas in the States, it was generally the generalship. And then they would do, like, you know, the overall is called something else, I think, down there. I forget, though. Jack of all trades or something. But and so we started off in that kind of environment. There was lots of really competitive tournaments, lots of really competitive players. But people didn't exactly, like, expect us to win ever. They expected us to be, like, a middle-of-the-pack, fun-to-play team, beer team. We started, we had no WTC events of any kind, no players pack. And me and a partner of mine, like a early Canhammer partner, John Green, we started the Canhammer team tournament, which was the first ever WTC or ETC at the time style tournament in Canada. That tournament has since grown to be the biggest team tournament in the country, or it, I guess it always has been, because yeah. It was the only one, and then even
the first, and then the largest, yes.
But that, so that's kind of how we started, and then people would come, and they would get, like, hooked on the team style, and I think it really appeals to a lot of those players that maybe don't want to play the most broken thing, and don't want to always have to beat the most broken thing, and they could spread out, and they can go in a car with their friends, and we've really tried to sell it, and so that tournament has grown to the point where when we put tickets online for the Canhammer team tournament, it sells out in under a minute, usually. Like, it's sold out with a 10-team waiting list, like, instantaneously. People have to wait online. And so we went from that kind of environment where now WTC is more common. So you see that tournament. We were just at a tournament in Sudbury, which is, like, a northern mining town, where they had, like... Yeah, it was a 7-hour drive for us. It's like a really kind of isolated place.
What a commitment.
Yeah, but they run a big team tournament. And
it was a good event.
It was actually really awesome, yeah. And Stud and Snotling, they run their team event this year. And there's a few more, like, different groups that are starting to run them around. So it's been gaining popularity. Bruno, who's our assistant captain of Team Canada, he runs all of his events, WTC, out of the Montreal region. And that's heavily influenced that region. And so we still have that kind of, I don't know if you guys have this with, like, UKTC and, like, Europe style, or I guess not in Poland, but we have a heavy ITC influence from the States. So most of our singles tournaments are still run, I'm going to say, like, the American ITC style. Whereas we're trying our best anyway. So it's definitely not a priority, but every year we get bigger and bigger and bigger. And this is the first year we've had over 30 applicants. And as far as community support, we're heavily supported. We have, like, a pay subscription to our team Discord that just allows us to do a lot of things, pays for our entrance fee for the team and stuff like that. And so the community is getting more and more supportive. And I would say 2019 is when we started shifting as a country to be like, we don't want to be that mid-tier or bottom-tier team that's there for fun. We want to win. And so we've been kind of shifting focus that way. And it's been going well.
You've made quite a bit of progress from what you're saying over the last couple of years. But I wanted to ask, how's that Patreon or whatever the platform is working out for you? Because I think you're not the only ones to have this sort of subscription going on. If it's paying the team fee, I think that's at least that. But how's that working out? And how much more time and effort do you need to put into the team to make that something that is beneficial for any subscribers?
Yeah, me, I don't do anything. I'll be very clear. So we have very distinct roles in our team. And so my job is very specifically managing the players. And we do it by a top 16. So I kind of make sure that the players are kind of aware, and I run the meetings and do that stuff. And I focus on the gaming aspect of the team. Our assistant captain, Bruno, he's really, really good at the community support. So he runs, and him and Jeremy, plus the coaching staff, they'll run kind of like the side thing. So we have our main team running scrimmages against each other. So we have 16, we'll keep playing. And then they'll run scrimmages with, like, whoever wants to from the kind of just the supporting tier. They get to play WTC style. They get to kind of interact with team players and learn the system. And it's kind of like we've created, like, this feeder system where we're training kind of the future of the team. And some people aren't there to join the playing staff. They never will. They just kind of want to get better and contribute. And so I think that's the key, is you just have to surround yourself with a lot of really good people. And that's what I feel like I've done. And so it's no work on me, and they do a lot of work, and but it's going really well. Yeah. And, you know, considering it's a subscription, we have a lot of people that are willing to kind of give us that, you know, little bit amount of money just to help us get there. So
I mean, there's also a fair few who are simply supporters, right? They subscribe to the Patreon to support the team, and they may not even join the Discord. They just want to show support to the team.
All right. Yeah, that makes absolute sense. So Francois, maybe you could shed some light on how the actual team is selected. So again, does it have anything to do with the top players at tournament, at singles events, or as you said, you look at those scrimmages in particular to draw the team that will go to the event? How does that happen?
So I wasn't doing the selecting, but from the selectee point of view, I can tell you how it went, and then maybe Chris can explain how the selecting actually goes. But we were very active very early on. I think when I applied to join the team was right after the last WTC, so that would have been September, right afterwards, basically. And right away, things started happening where we would get assigned games on TTS and scrims, and there'd be bi-weekly meetings. So a couple of times a month, you're on Discord talking about the team, how it's going. And from what I understand, the big deal about that is to show commitment. For the same reason that there's a nominal, it's not a big fee, but there's a nominal Patreon fee, it's just to show you're serious, right? And that you're going to actually commit and actually participate, because it's a lot of work. Building a competitive WTC team requires a ton of effort and a ton of practicing, and finding the right 8 people must be very hard, and is very hard for that reason. So I know that our coach, Jeremy, was keeping track of detailed statistics of who was playing what, when, against who was coming to meeting, who wasn't coming to meetings, and then obviously results outside of the scrims must matter. People who are winning tournaments or placing at tournaments, I'm sure that comes into the equation. But from my point of view, as someone applying for the team, I think that the big strength of the whole process was, A, it was fairly transparent, but B, it was also clearly aimed at showing that you are committed and will do the work. And of course, performance is important as well, but the commitment seemed to be a very large part of it.
Okay. All right. So you mentioned now in the conversation that you have obviously the captain, you have the assistant captain, you have a coach. So Jeremy doing all the data, Jeremy known from StatCheck, so probably a person addicted to numbers and addicted to
noted Excel wizard, Jeremy Atkinson.
Exactly.
The guy that doesn't sleep, yes.
Exactly. By the way, tell him to stop this and care for himself, because, you know, at some point he will just burn out if he doesn't stop. But for the time being, what he's doing is amazing. But again, coming back to, you know, captain, assistant captain, coach, how many people are you bringing with you? I mean, is there any broader staff that you have? Because again, Team Poland this year, you know, they're going crazy with like a captain, a media guy, coach, another coach. So there's like 5 people that are not playing that are coming. Is it the same for you guys?
It actually is this year.
All right.
In the past, no. We just would do the one coach, and it was something I was reluctant to expand into, and it wasn't that popular. I think last year was the first year you saw support staff for teams, and it made a lot of sense. We're structured in kind of, as I said, like multiple groups. So we're bringing the 9 players, which includes myself, 8 players, and then the head coach, which is Jeremy. So I want to distinguish that is the way that we have it structured is Jeremy kind of, it's almost like a business in that he runs like the coaching department. And so he's the head coach. And then he has like, I think it's like, it's 5 or 6 coaches underneath him, but only 4 are actually traveling with us. We also have a media person who is not traveling, but they do all the media stuff from home. So they'll do all the posting. They did it last year. It's Max Dubois. He's like a really good friend of ours. He does all of our Facebook and all those little art things. And it looks really nice and kind of our I think last year he did like head to head between like when we played other countries, he would kind of put our pictures and who played who. It was really, really cool. And so, yeah, so we're going with that this year. There should be 14 or 15 of us. Depends. Like this year they've given you kind of the option. You can buy multiple kind of non-player tickets for your team, whereas in the past, I think it was only one defined role. So should be pretty good. But as far as like what they're doing is we've kind of taken our coaching staff and we've given each of our coaches a subset of armies. And so each one of those coaches will be responsible when we're at the WTC for, so like there'll be one that's in charge of NIDs, right? So if I have to play a NID player or if we're doing pairings, that person will be the specialist on NIDs and maybe another army or somewhat like that. And so they'll be able to give us all advice and make sure we don't miss war gear and things of that nature when we're there. And then, yeah.
So I understand you're a playing captain, right?
I am, yeah. And so it's why it's more important, I think, for us to have the support staff in place to do that. And even our assistant captain is playing as well.
Okay.
Right. So speaking of becoming army specialists, what's your take on the fact that we've got a whole new edition in and this is going to be like the most major tournament that's happening in a very short space of time with the new rule set? Do you think that any data you might have had up till now is of any relevance, or is it just starting from scratch?
Well, it's definitely relevant. Like we practiced, we maybe shut down a few weeks ago, like a little bit, just to avoid burnout. Because right now is also the heavy tournament season in North America. I don't know if it's like that for you guys over there. Like it seems like we kind of have a lull during the hardcore winter months, and then it gets loose. So we all have tournaments every other weekend. So we lulled down, but we practiced right up to it. And our philosophy on that was, like, you're still playing the game. You're still kind of getting in that WTC mindset. And the more ready you can get, the better. It may not, you know, like next year, practicing this time of year will have more of an impact on the actual WTC than this year. Another thing that we did is as soon as they previewed that they were going to like a card-based system, is even though it was the wrong cards, it was the, you know, the ninth ed, what is it?
Maelstrom of War.
Maelstrom of War. Thank you. Yeah. Tempest of War. Sorry. I was going to say Maelstrom, but we started scrimmaging with that, right? And so we've been playing those cards for maybe a month or two now, even though they were the wrong cards, but just to get people changing their mindset. Another thing that we've been doing is we've been doing scrimmages between like our top 16, 8 and 8, and we've been just assigning people different armies that they never played. And so that was just to get people out of there kind of, because it was really easy in ninth ed to get into this, like, I pick these three secondaries, I put my, you know, I do this. And so we're just trying to shake things up in that kind of regard. And then I guess Francois could talk about what we're doing to prepare for the new edition.
Yeah, well, like Chris said, the fundamentals of the game aren't that different. Board positioning, target priority, movement, all that stuff is still more or less the same. Having played now 4 or 5 games of 10th edition since we've had the information, I feel it still feels like Warhammer. It's a different kind of Warhammer. The tempo of the game is different, and obviously the rules are different, but it doesn't feel that alien to me anyway. It feels like the fundamentals are still quite close. Now, when it comes to armies, I think that's a very different conversation. There's some armies that are obviously very/too good. I predict that unless something drastically changes, every single WTC team will have an Eldar player because and they probably all will have at least one and probably 2 or 3 Wraith Knights, you know, so we can make those predictions fairly easily. Where it gets hard is when you get to like the, you know, the top 3-4 probably semi-obvious, and after that it gets overwhelming. Because you have all of these data sheets. I don't know the actual number, but you know, 1,000+ data sheets, maybe more. And you have to try and figure out how they plug into each other and how they work. And the timeline for that is very short. So that is definitely a challenge. And I know that many of us are just frantically going through our favorite / assigned armies and putting them on the table and playing. And Chris and I played each other this weekend and trying to, you know, discover and find out what works and what doesn't work and what the actual peculiars of the game are now and how it's going to work. But all that work that we put in prior to that, that's not wasted work. That's still, I feel, very relevant.
Okay. So before we actually delve into questions about 10th, because there are some, I wanted to ask, because Pumbaa from the Polish national team said on one of the podcasts recently that what he really enjoys about the WTC, apart from the camaraderie and so on, is also the preparation part, in which you gather intel. And he said that it's almost, you know, impossible to be well prepared for this kind of an event without knowing a little bit in advance what the others are doing. So are you also investing time into that, or, you know, is it somehow difficult for you because of, I don't know, the distance, the different kind of meta that you're playing over there? I don't know. Well,
this year, does anyone know what they're doing?
Yeah, yeah. That's the thing. That is, you know, it comes back to Joker's question, like, you know, is Jeremy sad because his data might be irrelevant right now, or, you know, how are you approaching this?
Well, we will have data, like, we will have tournament data before the and it'll be too late. Like, once we'll have our lists already locked in, but we'll still be compiling the data for, let's say, matchups and improving that. As far as, like, yes, we historically have scrimmed against a lot of other countries. We don't do it as much right now. We have the opportunity to, but I think in a new edition shift, it's more important to keep some of your secrets or your list ideas a secret.
Your cards close to your chest, right?
Yeah, like last year,
close to the event, right?
Builds, right? And we chose to go a different way than other teams. We didn't take the double knights for a very specific reason. Did it work out or not? I don't, like, we think it was a mistake, but hindsight's 20/20. And so, yeah, keeping the cards, like, if you were to scrimmage with another country, you could be giving them all of your data that they could be, and they could be in a completely different direction. So it might not be a good thing. And I think that all goes back to this year, we selected different players than normal. So we changed our team selection to reflect the fact that it's a new addition. So we took maybe more chances on, I guess, like, they're still top tier players, but that they play a variety of factions and they didn't always stay to certain things. And we tried not to avoid, like, faction experts, but we do try it. And we have gotten, like, you know, there's those leaked, like, people have tournaments and you go on and you're like, hey, these are the Team England guys. What are their lists? And we've done that stuff before, but I think a lot of countries cover that up.
Yeah.
Nowadays, okay. But we have played Poland. Like, we used to scrimmage against them and stolen their lists and, well, didn't steal it. They sent them.
It's a good place to steal from.
Yeah, they sent it in a document to us, and we're like, "Oh, thank you." Yeah, you guys just rocked us, but now we know we're doing a bit better.
Yeah. So speaking of scrimmages, did you manage to get in a lot of international, like, scrimmages this season since last year's event? Did you play Poland over the last 12 months? I don't think we've played this time around.
No, we found Poland very hard with the time zones usually to finish our rounds. But yeah, we've played quite a few earlier on. A lot of countries didn't want to. So that's the one kind of thing that we noticed since the pandemic ended, is some countries just went off TTS completely. Mm-hmm. So we played a bunch. I can't remember the exact ones. They're in our Discord, though, because we've been doing this for 3 years now. So it's hard to remember which ones are which. We do have some kind of, like, partnerships with other countries that we use, like, you know, that we're willing to share information and practice against. But we're kind of waiting for the brackets right now, who's in which pod, because the fact that we got ninth means that we don't get first seed. Mm-hmm. We're just on the bottom, like, by one or two teams from the first seed. So we will be thrown in with one of the, you know, top six or top eight teams, right? In kind of the B sphere. So I think a lot of places don't want to necessarily give away their list to us because we could be in their pod. And then there's other places that, yeah, if we're not in their pod, we'll probably run a few practice games this summer if we can fit it in.
About the pod, by the way, wait, Joker, just a sec, because I'll use this space to make a small announcement.
For advertising. Again. Go on, then.
Exactly. So if someone hasn't watched or listened to the previous episode, then you will be very happy to find out that this very channel, Joker and myself, we will actually be doing the pods, and we will be doing them live and broadcasting them to you through this channel, so Contact Lost channel, but also through the WTC channel and so on. We intend to do this, you know, proper UEFA, FIFA style with like glass balls and small little balls inside, and we will be doing the draw and so on for your viewing pleasure. So make sure that you subscribe, like, hit the bell button to get the notification when it happens. Joker, back to you.
Yeah, so Chris, you've mentioned like friendly countries that you exchange information with. So would you be willing to tell us who you're mates with and maybe talk a little bit about some rivalries you might have at the WTC?
Or beef.
Or beef?
Yeah. Or beefs, yeah. Well, they're Canadian. They don't have beefs with anyone, do they?
That's not true. We have beefs. we try not to. Like, we have the... Like, we're very heavily, like, necessarily, like, a lot of our team members are, like, club mates and work with the Americans specifically. Obviously, we see them the most, and Jeremy's embedded in there. Historically, we've generally hung around, like, the Irish and the Scottish and kind of those circles. So a lot of the, you know, the English speakers that are people closer in time zones by a couple hours, which makes a huge difference when playing TTS. You know, 5 hours is a lot different than seven when you start factoring in like work life, mm-hmm. Things like that. So that's about, I think, as far as I want to go into that. but rivalries, yeah, like we've never beaten Poland ever. And I think you're our most played team as far as like adversaries. We didn't play Poland last year, but prior to that, we played every year and got like that was our. Like some years that was our first loss, like quite a few. And so I would say like, yeah, like it'd be nice to beat Poland because of that. We've definitely had some like back and forth rounds with like countries like Italy and stuff like that, that are, like, you could see as a rivalry. We would love to beat the Americans in placing, right? But that's just because we share the continent. So it'd be, that'd be really nice. But I think that's about it really.
Best in America.
Yeah, we don't put a lot of stock on that. We kind of try to focus inward and how we're going to do and how we perform. But yeah, it'd be nice to be the best in North America for once, right?
Yeah, so since you touched upon the results, obviously you guys want to win, but is there like a bare minimum placing that you would consider satisfactory now? I mean, obviously you probably want to do better than last year and so on, but do you like have a target?
Yeah, so every year it's very important that we set really clear goals as a team. So our team goals for this year, I can tell you what they were back in September because I have it up here. Has that changed? Did the addition change some of that? Yes, but our goal was top 10% is always our goal to strive for. So that would be top 9 if it's 30 teams. I think it's going to be a 9 or 10 would be top 10%.
I think your math is way off on that.
Sorry. Top 3 or 4. Sorry. It's been a long day of work. It just ended. We wanted 8 well-tested armies. That was another goal of our team. In the past, we've sometimes done last-minute meta shifts that have not worked out for us. So we wanted to prioritize that this year. One of our team goals was to have a great team dynamic. So that would be have a lot of, like, you know, synergize with each other and kind of get buzzing with each other. We're hoping to make top 3 painted armies this year, but with the new edition, that's really challenging. And then some of the other ones was like structured practice games and more team awareness nationally. So,
okay. Francois, a question to you, because yeah, taking what Chris has just mentioned into account, I wanted to ask about the team, no, not team, army selection philosophy, let's call it like that. Although philosophy is a huge word, but still, looking at what the Australians had done last year, for example, they came into the event with crazy ass lists that nobody really understood how they work. Well, not all of them, but some of them. That definitely could impress. That definitely, you know, took people by surprise. Would your philosophy be do something like that as well, surprise everyone, especially this year when it's fairly easy to actually surprise someone? Or would it be to bring lists that you have trialed and tested over and over and over? I think Chris alluded to that a second ago, but still, which one of those is it?
Well, this year I think either of those things is kind of up in the air because the short turnaround time. But speaking for myself, when I go to a tournament, I always feel a lot more comfortable doing well with a list that I've played a lot. So if I have to choose between, oh, I've had this genius idea that I think will confuse everyone and win me the game, but going into it cold, or this is this thing that I've practiced over and over again, and I know, and the muscle memory is there, maybe I'm too conservative, but I would go for that Old Faithful every time. And the way that I approach army selection for singles, so we're talking about a different world here, obviously, but over the last 2 years, let's say, I've played three different factions, and I'll play a faction, a strong faction, for, I don't know, 100 games, 6 months, up to a year. That was Dark Eldar. That one lasted a very long time.
For a
but,
reason.
And you can feel the difference. Even something as strong, I did Tyranids for a while, and then Iron Hands. Those were my treatment factions of the last 2 years: Dark Eldar, Tyranids, Iron Hands. And you can feel the difference when you go from one to the other. And the progression, for me anyway, as far as results are concerned, and winning games and being comfortable winning games, the more you play, the better you get. So I think it's very easy to outsmart yourself if you do something like that, especially on a short turnaround time. Mm-hmm. And people will find like crazy lists that no one else saw coming, and hopefully we can do that as well. But if we do, I'm hoping that we write the list next week and then practice it for 6 weeks before WTC and not right. come up with it 3 days before list submission.
Okay. Yeah, that's a fair answer. So, Chris, a question to you. And now we can start delving into the 10th edition. I guess this is what people are after as well. So from a captain's perspective, in a team's event, how do you view the challenges that you are going to face? I mean, to me, I might be completely wrong about it, but to me, it seems like this time at this tournament, there's going to be a lot more randomness than there used to be. So, I mean, obviously, armies will be unpredictable and so on, but I mean, the system itself now has a fair bit of randomness, because predicting the outcome of the battle with cards, gambits, different terrain, I guess even things like rapid ingress, which allows someone to act in someone else's turn. Do you think that from your view, it's going to be more complex to, you know, collect information from your players, and you know, you go to one player and you ask him, hey, what score are you going to bring? How is it looking? The guy will not be able to tell you, or what he tells you might be actually skewed because suddenly the opponent does something out of turn or something like that. How do you view this? Is that something that you're afraid of?
I wouldn't say I'm afraid of it, because like, I would say as precise as people think they are with pairings, It all what you just described is always kind of an issue. Like, people overestimate their abilities, people overestimate matchups. I have players, and one of my good friends, he's played on our team with Francois and I, like tons of team events in Canada. And every time you ask him how his game's going, he's like, it's just okay. And then he ends with a 20. So it's definitely very normal. A lot of what I do is like, I think you got to put faith in your players, and you can't micromanage. You can't look at it. I can't be worrying about what Francois is doing with his army. I have to worry about me and mine. And I have to trust that Francois and the support structure that we've put in place with Jeremy and our coaching staff, that they're getting that army as right as they can get. They're getting the reps in, and they're kind of uncovering those blind spots on that specific faction. And if we get it wrong, we get it wrong. You just have to learn to kind of adjust on the fly at the WTC, which I think is the real big thing. Now, most of our players are playing in the singles prior to it at the War Masters, so we'll get some data points to kind of correct that. We have Jeremy, the stats guy, who will have, so I will know going in with my army what the average score is into the army that I'm playing against. And then I'll have to assess the difference, like, you know, is that my army skewed? Is my army different? And then I'll be able to kind of fix those things out. I think for a team like ours that's up and coming in the middle tier, I think it's better for us the more shakeup and the short notice. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think of when the Australians won last year, and they worked their ass off for a year, and they practiced and they played and they did all that stuff. And so, and when you talk to, or you hear the English guys talk about their team, they play like every weekend, they all go to the big tournaments, and those guys are like on point. Well, they don't have that either this year. Right. So I feel like it kind of gives teams like us a shot more so than years past. Now we've gone in the past, one edition, that's the thing. This is like my third edition change. It just like, yeah, when you go there and there's an edition change, there's just crazy stuff that you can't account for and you might miss the meta, but you have to, like, as long as you can, as a team, put the process in place and adjust round to round. So if I play, I don't know, Tyranids round one and he dumpsters me and we were like, oh, that's a green. As long as we don't do that again, the next round, we're good to go. Right. So I think that's the real key, is being, you know, agile and flexible and able to do those things.
Yeah, so it sounds like having Jeremy is a massive asset with all the data he can gather. But since you have him, how have the pairings historically gone for you? I mean, did they usually go as expected? And then if you lose a game, for example, do you think that it was a matter of misjudging a matchup or more a player skill thing or dice?
Well, it's always all three. It's you can't, it's not always, like, matchups are never a perfect science. Players, like, you know, there are better players at the WTC than players on our team, right? Like, this is the best players in the world, right? And historically, there's very few people in Canada that go and win international really large TV, that tournament, sorry. So we do have to kind of factor that in a little bit, right? That we need to be more on point. But really, it's kind of like you just kind of do your best and then learn from your mistakes and see how it goes. I don't know what your take on that, Francois, is.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. You also have to be, I think, careful not to overthink it in the moment. I think it's easy to sometimes draw the wrong lessons from something that happened. But beyond that, I agree with everything you said.
Yeah, like you know, because there's matchups that are green statistically, but they're not green for our team, right? They're not green for our player. They're not green. They'll be a bit lower, and I think you just have to set that. And
sometimes a matchup might be a 9 out of 10, and you just happen to be that one, right?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Okay. Do you know by any chance, because, again, to people who are unfamiliar with the WTC, what happens at the WTC is we have teams of 8 versus 8 playing against one another. And then what happens is it is quite important for the teams to be able to select the tables that they are going to play, because canonically there are 8 different tables that the game is being played on. And those tables differ in that how much terrain there is on the table. So, for example, it is very important to get a shooty army onto a table that has less terrain or fewer pieces of terrain so that they can shoot their opponent off the table. Now, to my question, do you know already from the WTC Discord or somewhere else, is this tradition going to be there this year with the new edition as well? Or are they planning something different? Do we know already what the so-called WTC style terrain is going to be this year? Francois, maybe you can start.
Nope, I don't think we know, and that's one of the big things that I can't wait to find out. They have indicated that they are reworking their terrain maps, as they should, because the terrain rules are different. And having played 10th edition on classic WTC tables, I can see some stuff not working very well and some tweaks that they probably will want to make, and they are working on that. They've said publicly in the WTC Discord that the terrain maps are being worked on and will be released soon. The issue is, and they're working very hard on that, I don't begrudge them taking their time. I want them to get it right. I'm just saying, from the player's perspective, this will influence list writing quite a bit. So once we see what the tables look like, what I think is good now on the current WTC tables might change radically because of the new terrain maps. So it's both exciting and incredibly terrifying at the same time.
So, Chris, have you had any regrets, perhaps? Because I know that it was the captain's vote that decided that it's going to be 10th edition that is going to be played. Again, do you regret that decision, seeing what the edition looks like now?
What did you vote, first of all? For or against?
I think we voted for the new edition, if I remember correctly. I don't remember. It was actually a while ago now.
You did.
And when you have three, your memory's garbage. I think it's for the better. I think, you know, it does, as people, some people look at it as we wasted all this time in preparation. And we did get a lot of that in our team thing. Like, you know, oh, why are we doing this? It's a new edition. And you know, it kind of helped us weed out maybe people that weren't as dedicated or willing to push through. I don't want to be playing 9th edition. We went to a 9th edition team tournament last weekend, which obviously was like, well, I guess it was the weekend before last. So it was like before the points and before all the indexes really came out the week before. And it was actually I was tired of playing 9th there, right? Like we were kind of ready to end it. And so I'm glad we're doing it. I think it's better for us. I think, you know, it puts us into a good place to kind of get a good head start on this edition now, right? And it helps us in singles and in our individual Warhammer kind of careers for the year. If we were playing 9th, we would be losing these like 3 months of all of our practice and all of our list writing, and we wouldn't be building the correct models. We wouldn't be painting the correct models. And so we would be coming out of the WTC, however we place, with like almost like a wasted skill set, right? And we'd be going into the singles market behind everybody else. Whereas this year, I think it's going to be the opposite, is we should be coming out with a significant advantage over a lot of other singles player for the big tournament season that usually starts around September, right?
Yeah, from a player perspective, it's new, it's shiny, it's exciting, it's imperfect, obviously, but I would feel, I think, much less enthused about going there and playing if I was playing a rule set that's been dead for 3 months.
Yeah, I can 100% agree with that sentiment. One of you guys mentioned that, I think it was Chris, that you've had people on the team play Tempest of War cards for a while just to get prepped to the new style missions. So, Francois, do you think that actually was worth the time, the practice? Do you feel like there's a real benefit in that?
Yes, if only because the 9th edition and building them even all the way back to 8th, we were kind of in a solved meta where you'd play your army and you'd play the same secondaries almost every game. I finished the edition on Iron Hands, or for team events, I was on World Eaters, and I'd know that 99% of games almost, I'd play these three secondaries and just go. I don't even have to look at the opponent's list. This is what I'm doing. And so the cards introduce a wrinkle in that, where you have to adapt on the fly to an evolving situation in game, which is harder to do. Of course, you can fix your cards in 10th edition, but unless your opponent is giving you a free secondary, you probably shouldn't. So most of the time, you're going to be playing the random draw. And those just on a dime change a game entirely. Oh, all of a sudden, I have to go do that thing to get me those points, and that wasn't the plan that I had in mind the turn prior. And so it requires from the players a certain flexibility that we've, I think, lost in the old calcified secondary system of 9th edition. So just getting used to the cards and the complete chaos that they can bring to a game, I do feel was worthwhile.
Right. So to build on that question, again, when I interviewed Liam from Team Australia, he mentioned that like 90%, if not 100% of their team, of all the players on the team, they are used to playing cards because they remember 7th edition, the end of 8th edition, where they had, there were also cards, although some of the ITC players, for example, might not remember that because they were already playing ITC missions. But here in Poland, we actually played cards at the end of 8th. So we are kind of used to it. How about your players? Are all of them experienced with cards, or is this like a new concept to them?
Some are like, yeah, not like Francois, obviously, is like relatively new to the competitive scene, but there's the core group of the team is like, we've played it before. Like, as you said, I've been playing cards it was my preferred way. Like, I think
but not in the last 3 years.
Not in the last 3 years, yeah. But prior to that, yeah, we played. So it'd be a mix. But yeah, maybe we have some more work to do than maybe the established poll. Like, I don't know how, like, the average age of your team. We also, we do try to bring new people. So one of our mandates is to, without compromising the integrity of the team, obviously, we're not just going to pick for pick's sake, but we try to get two new people that have never gone every year to kind of keep that kind of pool moving. And I think if you have too static of a lineup every year, people might not apply, right? Because they might not make the team. And so because we have that, yes, we have Francois and probably a couple other, like Jeremy's probably never really been that familiar with cards before because he never really played older editions, but myself, Ridvin, Bruno, we're all well familiar.
All right. So you've mentioned Ridvin. So to people who might not connect the dots, Ridvin is Skari from Skardcast. For eternity, devoted Drukhari player. So definitely a celebrity, definitely someone that people in Poland have heard about as well. And this brings me to the next question, then I'll use it as a segue. There are plenty of celebrities now in this community. There are plenty of celebrities in Canada.
Quite big ones, actually, I'd say.
Yourselves included, Francois. I've seen you at StatCheck fairly recently. Chris, you have your own podcast, so you are celebrities yourselves. There are celebrities in the UK, multiple celebrities in the US. Many of them you will face at the event. Does that change anything for you? I mean, are those matchups different? Do you treat people like this differently? And Chris, a question to you as a captain, do you think that your players can handle this just psychologically, playing against celebrities?
That's an interesting question.
Ah.
Because I try not to think of them that way. I try to, like, there's obviously people that I'd be like stoked to meet and are really fun, but I don't really, I try to just think of people as people and kind of treat them as equals. And just because somebody's a celebrity doesn't mean that they're, you know, there's some kind of, like, when you're on a podcast or stuff like that, you know, you talk the big game, but, you know, some of the best players, like, you've never heard of, right? Like on all these other teams. So I don't think it's an impact for me. I know that some younger people on our team do have that kind of deer in the headlights when they meet these people, or even like just playing a European is kind of crazy for some people, right? Like we had Conrad 1 year, he's like a Polish Canadian. And so we played Poland and he wouldn't shut up about, like, oh my God, like I'm playing my, you know, cause like his family emigrated from Poland. Right. And I kind of feel the same way when we play Italy, cause my family came from Italy. But in that regard, yeah, I treat them like that. I don't know, Francois, do you get starstruck these days?
I used to, but I think it's less a question of age, as you're alluding to, and more competitive age. How long have you been doing this? The first time I played Ridvin, to use him as an example, was in a Drukhari mirror match, and my brain kind of melted. I just couldn't deal with the fact that I was playing Dark Eldar versus Dark Eldar against Ridvin, and I played terribly that game. It's not one of my best games. So we had fun. Like, he's a great guy. I love him. But so for that game, it played a role, right? I'm playing the Dark Eldar guy, and my brain just, like, shut off. But that was a couple of years ago, and I feel that now that I've actually won GTs and majors, the pressure doesn't get to me in the same way that it used to. And so, like, I'm in my 40s, so I am old, but I don't think that's why. I think it's because now that I'm, I don't know, 5 years into my playing competitive Warhammer, I don't act the same way or react in the same way than I did, like, four years ago. Whereas Chris has been playing competitive for even much longer than that. And I think that's the main kind of difference.
Yeah. And it's like, it's funny too, cause, like, it just made me think of Steven Box, right? Like, when we played him, it was before he started his channel, right? So he was on the UN team. So I met that guy cause he was the guy with the six pack that took his shirt off and played a game. And then he started this really successful channel and became, as you said, a celebrity, right? So,
and his six pack is now all over the place.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And he I think he likes to post that a little.
I have to say, let's be honest. If I had those muscles, I would take my shirt off all the time too.
Oh, me too. Oh yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, we would completely. All be sitting shirtless now, wouldn't we? So I was going to ask about celebrities, as we've called them, but from a bit of a different perspective. Do you think that having this number of quite popular content creators in Canada, is this beneficial for a hobby and in the long run for the team as well? Do you have like new people coming in to tournaments saying, oh yeah, I've seen this YouTube channel and I want to try the game out, and then they get hooked into competitive play?
Yeah, for sure. 100% for the growth of the game. It's massive. The people who quote unquote grow up in the hobby watching Mini Wargaming, one of the bigger Canadian channels, the biggest probably, or Play on Tabletop. They're out west in Vancouver, or Scarcast, or listening to Chris's and I's podcast, or Dustin's podcast. The fact that there's so much Warhammer media and attention helps grow the game. And even in the relatively short time that I've been playing, the game has exploded tremendously. I think worldwide, Jeremy was telling me that the stats show that year on year, it's about a 40% growth or something like that, which is massive, incredible. But if I even think back of the number of GTs that were available in 2018, 2019, like pre-COVID, it was kind of hard to get your six events for the ITC rankings. Now I can, without leaving town, comfortably go to eight GTs or majors. It's like completely different.
Okay, so I agree. I mean, it's hard to disagree with the statistics, but I agree that the game has grown. I see it around me as well. You know, we have Polish people speaking to the Canadian team on a podcast. That's the best proof.
That's wild, isn't it?
That is wild.
That's crazy. But taking all this, you know, let's treat this as context. Warhammer is in a very good place. At the end of ninth edition, it's a very healthy game competitively. There are some. So I very recently. I've listened to one of the British podcasts, Fireside Podcast. Hello to Vic and David, who record that. They are good friends of ours. Their most recent episode is actually an episode around critique of 10th edition. So we are taking a game, or Games Workshop is taking a game that is in a very healthy place, very well-established place that competitive players enjoy and want to attend events, and they blow this up. Like they decide to introduce a new edition. You're nodding your head, so I assume you've listened to that podcast. Yeah, exactly. So do you share their sentiment that this new edition is probably not really well thought through? And again, how does that affect the morale of the team going to a team's event? Francois, you can start.
Yes and no. So I did listen to the episode, and I agree with many of their points. I also disagree with many other points. Maybe I'm just an optimist, but I actually like the bones of the game now. Having played four or five games of 10th edition, having read everything about it, I can see the problems, and I can see where it feels like it was rushed out. I can tell you that this game probably could have benefited from like 3 to 6 more months of polishing. But the core, to me anyway, seems good. I love the missions. I love the card system. The basic core rules are as precise as they've been. That 18-page glossary that they released that defines what a D6 is and, you know, all of these pages and pages of things feels like there was a real attempt and mostly a success at building a cohesive core rule set. And I love that. And they've also shown that they're responsive. There was the incredible Death Watch combo that lasted 18 hours, right? Before they went, oh no, yeah. Oh no, and fixed it. Now, are there issues with the game? Yes, tons. But that's, I think, maybe, and we probably shouldn't excuse it like that, but it is kind of the nature of such a radical big change. And as long as the foundation is strong, and I personally, anyway, I know some people disagree, but I personally think it is, then you can tweak it a little bit. One of the points that the Fireside guys made was about Overwatch, right? Well, if it turns out that Overwatch is a problem, you make it 2 CP or once a game. And you can solve it, right? And of course, there's many of these problems, but incrementally, I do have a non-zero amount of faith that they are solvable problems. I don't think the game is fundamentally broken and we should just bin it. I think the bones are good. We just need to rein in some of the stuff that's a little too strong. And if there are some things in the core rules that need addressing, then I'm confident they will get there. Now, the next 6 months might be real whack, but I'm confident that in 6 months we'll have a great game.
Yeah, so don't you think that...
Burn the Elder for now and we're good.
Yeah, that's some have opted for that already. But Francois, you've mentioned the 18 pages FAQ document. Isn't that just testament to bad rules writing if you need to release...
No, I think it's testament pages? To players being who they are. So some of that stuff I feel did not need defining. Some of it did, and the issue is... The rules are complicated. It's a giant game. It's a very large rule set. There's going to be stuff that falls between the cracks. Mm-hmm. And I think that's okay. We shouldn't expect perfection. We should expect them to try for it. And like I said, they probably could have, you know, tried for 3 more months and gotten us something a little bit better. But I look at the rules glossary as a wonderful addition. Because they're going, okay, so we've got our rules. These are our rules. And here are things that in our rules... might be perhaps for some people confusing. Some of the stuff, though, some of it is just basic English. You don't really need to define what within means. The dictionary does that for you. But they feel they have to because of the ways that some players, not always in good faith, try to break the game. And I'm at least happy that they're recognizing that that is something they should be doing and that they're doing it.
Okay. And Chris, as a captain of a team, in this brand new world of rules, or you know, addition of rules, are you afraid that there are going to be gotchas that could be, like, you know, traps and pitfalls for your team?
So there always could be. I think you're going to get the gotchas when it comes to matchups, and the gotchas when it comes to, like, list writing. Like, somebody's going to write a list that you don't expect. It works a different way than you expect. On the tabletop, I can't imagine there'll be too many, because one of the things that most good players do is they have, like, a conversation the whole game, right? And so as long as you know the key things to ask for, like, you know, for example, in ninth, it's like, can you heroic if I'm here? And, you know, if the guy says no and then does a 6-inch heroic, you're like, well, I asked you, you said no, you know. You're gonna get the table flipped. So as long as, like, the players kind of keep their stuff on board, I think we'll be fine for that. I agree with Francois. Like, the core rules are really good, and they removed a lot of the gaminess, or it feels like, and that'll always come again. But the fact that you can't wrap anymore, and everybody can just fall back. Yes, you might lose your models, but at least you can do it. You don't have to spend a CP. There's no, like, haha, right? The fact that you have to end in base, can you mitigate that? Yes. But at least it's better than it was. Now, as far as, like, the balance and how they wrote it, yeah, you could say, like, they should release a polished game. But, you know, there's this, like, famous saying that I try to model most things of my life off of, and it's don't let great get in the way of good, right? And so sometimes it's better to release a good version of the game. You could argue this is not the, like, some people might argue this isn't a good version, but you know, great and perfection can take a really long time to reach. And there's something to be said for 3 months of pain with a million, I'm just making up numbers, with a million people playing, you'll discover that stuff a lot quicker than in kind of their closed circles. And I think in the past, GW has kind of proven too that their closed circles of playtesters, they can't discover this stuff anyway, right?
Yeah, it's just surprising that sometimes, you know, they've worked so hard to tweak ninth edition to make it what people actually enjoyed at the end, and then some of the decisions at the beginning of 10th edition seem like they took all that knowledge that they gathered and put it in the bin, which is completely not understandable to me.
You mean indirect, for example? Yeah.
Indirect, for example. Exactly. Yes,
there we are.
That very rule
point.
Yeah.
But I think games fail, right? Like, if you release the same game, like, there's examples of people releasing the same game over and over again, and they are successful. I think, though, if they were just to release, you know, 10th and it was like 9.5, I think eventually they would just stop selling and the player base would diminish, right? Just because of the staleness. And I think you have to inject this chaos. I'd be surprised, like, if you'd have to watch GW stock over the next, but I wouldn't be surprised if their sales are going through the roof right now, right? And so when you take a step back, you look at it, I know that gamers hate to hear that, like, it's sales driven, but I'm sure sales were starting to diminish near the end of the edition because people didn't need to, you know, change their list, buy it. And then, yeah, now they're going to spike. And so that's how this company is going to stay afloat. And if this company stays afloat, they can then continue to provide us with enjoyment for the next 10 years, right? Whereas if you look at other games like War Machine, they kind of blew up with a new edition, but like that was a really stale game that sat stale for a very long time, very competitive, very samey. And then kind of they just imploded, right? Like at the end.
And then we need to remember that the competitive Warhammer 40K is a particle of the fan base. So they're not doing it for us. I'm sure they are doing it for all the people who collect, paint, model, take, you know, do pictures with, play thematic games, crusades, and so on and so on. So we are just a tiny percentage of all those players.
And also there are people like at the end of ninth, if you were like a competitive player like us or Francois, and you're able to afford multiple armies or build. So Francois is playing like the new filth all the time, whatever.
But it's not meta chasing if you already own it.
You know, there are people that are playing like crappy armies and were struck. They wouldn't say that ninth was competitive, right? Because they only play, I guess, Tyranids near the end, right? And it was like if you were like a diehard Tyranid player and all you played, you had your year of awesomeness and then you were
neutered.
You wouldn't call the end of ninth competitive, right? And actually, I played Sisters a lot through ninth edition. And I would say at the end of ninth, I didn't feel they were that competitive, right? So it wasn't a good addition for me. I don't think this new one is either, but it is what it is.
You own Custodes, you'll be fine.
But here's hopes that at least they react quickly because now they have the tools, right? They finally moved away from paper to digital versions of everything. I hope this allows them to react quickly to the, you know, ever-changing.
Well, you can tell that some of the lessons that they unlearned is because the Leviathan book went to print probably a year ago.
That's true. That's also true.
And like, honestly, just the fact that these indexes are free, like I don't think we should like diminish, like this is unheard of. Like, so they
eighth indexes you had to buy. Yeah.
Yeah. You had to buy them and people, I think, burned them all. Now I have some on a shelf, but this is a huge deal for them. This whole like free rules, we're giving it all away for free. Like I don't have my Leviathan box. I haven't bought technically besides models, which I ordered too many. But besides models, I haven't bought anything and I'm playing the new edition. Like this is unheard of.
Yeah. I showed up to your house, but I printed cards myself on just like my laser printer and just roughly cut them out. And we just played.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They felt terrible.
We did the same last
weekend. The actual cardboard will be much better, but for now that's what we had.
Yep.
Yeah, so we gotta be careful, like that we don't set our expectations too high. I guess it's like, and I'm like, first of all, I'm an optimist, but you know, I've been playing for 20 years. I would like to play for another 20 until I die of a heart attack. But
at the table.
All right, we've been going on for a while, so I think we'll wrap up now, guys. Thanks very much for coming in. It was a great pleasure to have you on. But before you go, would you like to say some famous last words or plug anything you might be involved in?
I'd love to plug. You know, I'll plug the Canadian WTC team and our community. You know, thank you everybody for your support and. I'll give a special thanks to Max, our media guy, who, you know, spends a lot of work doing that and doesn't get a lot of credit because he doesn't even get to travel with us. But that and yeah, you know, just, you know, thanks for having us. And that's it.
Yeah, this was great. Fun conversation. Thanks, guys.
And likewise,
thanks. The same. Yeah, exactly. So we've been contactless. We're doing this WTC coverage. We've had Team Canada on. And if you like what we do, subscribe us on YouTube, please, on Spotify or wherever you might be listening to, because we also try to be everywhere, even in your refrigerators, if they got Spotify connection or any other podcast media thing going on. We're also trying our best on Facebook, Instagram, and anything
even Twitter.
Else. Yes, and there's also a TikTok that will include Tweaks dancing one day.
Good. I look forward
if to we it. Win, if we win the WTC, then perhaps you'll see me dance. But this will be the last thing that you'll see before your eyes explode. So
you know, I was careful. About to say less permanent than a tattoo bet, but actually, the internet lives forever.
Exactly, I don't know. Like exactly. That Belgian beer is pretty strong. I'm sure we could get you dancing.
Better not, but I can't, you know, promise anything. Anyway, thank you guys. It's been a great pleasure to have you. And yeah, fingers crossed for hopefully the first place. Although I shouldn't be saying that, but I already said it. So good luck, guys.
Thank you. Thanks. We'll take all the good vibes. Have a good
one. Exactly.
Right. Definitely do.
So yeah, to everyone, until next time. Bye-bye.
Bye. Cheers.